Hey everyone, welcome back to the 443 Security Simplified. I'm your host, Mark LaLiberty, and joining me today is...
Quarantine Joe.
Corey
Knockreiner.
Also known as Corey Knockreiner, who just let out the biggest yawn right before saying that. I'm sorry for interrupting your nap.
Pretty much.
Mr. Quarantine Knockreiner.
Us getting ready to listen to your voice for the next hour.
That backfired. With that, let's just jump into the news before I get burned even more. So let's start this week with another piece of news from our newest favorite company. I feel like for the last year, we always talked about Facebook once a week, and now it seems like every week we're talking about Zoom now.
Zoom.
So last week, researchers found a database of 530,000 Zoom credentials for sale online on an underground marketplace. Now, it doesn't appear that Zoom themselves were breached. Zoom put out some statement basically saying they didn't believe that there was a direct breach of their databases, and instead this looks more likely to be the result of a credential stuffing attack, which we've talked about a few times. We've seen a few of like this style of database show up for different services. And credential stuffing is basically where an attacker takes credentials that they stole from other breaches or just obtained for free online, like anyone can, and then try and use them on other services because, as we know, a lot of people are pretty bad at picking unique passwords for each of their services. So they likely found these reused credentials that worked on Zoom, and then packaged them up and sold them on the underground for, I think it was 10 to a penny is the headline I read. Doesn't seem like, you know, it's not as bad as the vulnerabilities we've seen in the past. This one isn't even really Zoom's fault. It's mostly their users' fault for picking passwords that were A, able to be cracked from another breach, and then B, most likely existed in another breach because they reused their password. And I feel like we've given advice on this a few times. Corey, you want to see if the third time's the charm? Because yeah. I know the whole world listens to this podcast.
Well, password-wise, change your password over and over again whenever this happens. Don't use the same password everywhere. Use a different one. It better be long and strong. Of course, all that's hard for a human to do, so use a password manager. And beyond all that, just don't trust your password. Use multi-factor authentication on top of it so that your password is not the only thing you rely on.
And I'll even admit that there are still some times where I'll sign up for some random thing and use, like, it's not a crappy password, but it's the same password between accounts. But then I still go after the fact, and I call it spring cleaning, and I actually just went through it this year where I go through in my password manager. It can identify every single one of those accounts that uses a shared password. It's a feature of LastPass. I'm sure other password managers have it too. And then I go through and pick, you know, a couple dozen of them or all of them if there aren't that many, and go and reset them to more difficult passwords then. Because I get it, sometimes you sign up for something, you're in a hurry, you just want to get in, you don't want to click the extra buttons to generate a password, save it in the manager, so you just type random crap in, but still go back after the fact and fix it, hopefully. So next up on the news, security firm Terbium, I believe is how you pronounce it, Terbium Labs, released a report that they called their data commodity report, where they basically studied different items for sale on several different dark web marketplaces to identify trends. They went after three or four of the main dark web marketplaces that are still running right now. And they actually found some, in my opinion, pretty interesting stuff in this report. The big one that stood out to me was that they found that 49% of marketplace listings in the data category. So excluding services like DDoS attacks or hackers for hire, and excluding tools like malware tools. They found that 49% of all of their marketplace listings were guides on how to use stolen information, like how to set up fraudulent bank accounts, how to create phishing emails, how to steal money out of victims' accounts. This is in comparison to some of the other categories they looked at, like actual personal data, accounts and credentials, split over financial and non-financial, and then templates for creating your own tools also. And I thought it was actually interesting, like, so 50% of all listings were guides. And I guess that kind of makes sense because they're probably low effort to actually create one and then stick it up. But it also kind of makes sense in that, like, data theft is so prevalent right now that it makes sense that there would be a marketplace on how to use that stolen data now. And they didn't have any statistics on how many people are actually buying all these guides, but still 49% of listings is pretty significant.
Yeah, I'm not surprised. A lot of the underground forums we go to, even the, like, there are various levels of dark web and underground forums. Some are pretty high tier, some are low tier. But even the low tier ones have a lot of guides on some of the gross stuff these cyber criminals do. They find all kinds of ways to scam and trick and monetize things, some of it having to do with inappropriate materials. And one of the forums we go to for database links, I often see guides on one particular gross inappropriate scam that they always sell to others.
And so they included some data in this report also. They found that the average cost for a guide was about $3.88, though most of them came bundled as multiple guides in a few different categories. Looking outside of just the fraud guides, they looked into the like accounts and credentials. And interestingly, in the financial sector, accounts averaged $33.16 per record, with lows of as low as 5 and highs as high of 500. Again, there's no data on whether any of these were actually selling. But you'd have to think that if they're posted, someone would, there's obviously some sort of market for it. I guess our takeaway for that is your data is out there, and now the bad guys are finally learning how to use it.
Finally. These underground economies aren't really new. They've been doing it for a long time. Prices and values have changed. That's about it.
I wonder, like, you have to wonder how many of that 49% of the listings are the exact same guide that someone bought or stole and then just changed the title on it and then posted their own post for it. Like, I have to...
Happens all the time.
It's probably not like eBay where they charge you up front to post these listings. Most of them are like actual just forum places, so it's all free. And so there's literally no cost just to stick your own thing up there, I guess.
And some of the...
We all know that...
Some of the...
Go ahead.
Better, and by better, I guess I mean worse, underground sites actually have moderators that will verify posts, whether it's stolen information or maybe the quality of the guide. But to your point, there's plenty where I've definitely seen people where they literally resubject a post with someone else's guide and just sell the same thing or trade the same thing. But if you go to some of the deeper ones where you actually have to get invited in, I do know some of the value of the moderator is to, like, if you're trying to buy and sell between people that are obviously criminals like you, you need someone
like
to say, hey, this is real, like you specifically, Mark. By that, I mean other forum members.
Yes.
You know, trust is pretty low. So usually the moderator of some of these these underground sites actually acts as a validation for the quality of what's being sold. And that's why they get a percentage for the sale.
I know it's hard to believe that cyber criminals are untrustworthy and might post effectively copyrighted material from other cyber criminals.
Yeah,
but
who would imagine? Why would a cyber criminal do that? They're such nice, moral, law-abiding people.
Exactly. So moving on to the next news story out of last week that I also found pretty interesting. So researchers over at Carbon Black just posted a bunch of data from their own customer base where they were charting the effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on cyber attack targets. And so they looked at the months of February and March. And one of the stats that jumped out was between February and March, they saw a 38% increase in cyber attacks targeting financial institutions, which pushed them to 52% of all cyber attacks in that data set. And in comparison, attacks targeting the retail sector went from 31% of all attacks in February to just 1.6% of all attacks in March. And I thought this was interesting because this really mirrors what we're seeing even outside the cyber landscape. Like, retail is really slowing down. People aren't going out to shop. If they are, it's just to go to the grocery store to pick up the necessities and come home, which means that there's less money flowing through them and less attention and probably less opportunities to execute a cyber attack on them. What are your thoughts on that, Corey?
The weird one, though, is healthcare, though, right? It sounds like healthcare attacks are down, but Maybe that's because there is a little bit of kindness in ransomware authors' hearts, but I feel like hospital visits are up definitely in some countries and states. So now would be an opportune time for a malicious jerk to disrupt their patient records or something. So it is interesting how healthcare is down, though I agree with you on retail, financial, on the other hand, where people are trying to pay their rent, get their government help checks and stuff like that. I could see financial being up. Healthcare is just the weird one.
And Kat actually mentioned it in our interview last week, how some cyber criminal like organizations came out and said, "Oh, we're not going to attack hospitals with ransomware anymore." And she had the great point of, "Oh, great. Good for you. Way to be a good person."
Yeah.
Like, really, so outside of the COVID pandemic, you would attack them with ransomware, a hospital where people are trying to, receive life-saving treatment. It's ridiculous. But yeah, they noted in their data that healthcare is normally one of the top three verticals on a monthly basis, but it was down to seventh in the data set behind other categories like manufacturing, computer and electronics, and government. And if you look at the data, it was actually a pretty distant seventh. So interesting seeing the trends move like that. They went into a bit of a deep dive on some of them, like in the financial sector, the one that jumped up. They said 71% of attacks in the financial sector were using a Trojan called Cryptic. Which is actually the same Trojan that was found in use during the Ukraine power grid attacks back in 2015. And that kind of goes with a lot of stuff we see where some of these big Trojans are reused over time because they basically just still work. Like, it's really easy to run them through a packer or a cryptor to make them hide from traditional anti-malware engines, which means you need to rely on better tools in order to detect them, and the attackers can still continue to use them if you aren't using those tools.
Depending on where you bought from, often if you have source code, they're very modular. So the actual Visual Basic or the project for the Trojan is pretty modular and can be updated over years and years and years, just like any other code project. So it's not unusual for them to stick around for a decade.
Yep. And I have a feeling that we're going to see attacks against the financial sector and just involving finance continue to go up here in the next few months. Like, everyone just started receiving, if you qualified for it, your stimulus checks in the United States this week. And there's most likely going to be a large amount of phishing attacks around that. Like, people will have questions if they didn't get theirs, and it's an opportunity for a cyber criminal to say, "Oh, hey, click here to get your stimulus check." Because we all know that big things like that are usually big targets for phishing attacks.
I was just going to say, other types of financial related attacks might be higher nowadays with working at home. Luckily, a coworker ignored it, but I'll probably be writing a Sicklicity blog post about a phishing attack that went to accounting, basically saying, "Hey, I'm so and so at WatchGuard. I'm one of your employees. I want to change my direct deposit information to a new direct deposit." And so it was obviously a phishing attack. It wasn't really the person asking. But I think people realize that everyone's working remotely, including maybe the people asking for the changes and the accountants themselves. So they hope that might help with these type of classic. I mean, it's not really an unusual phishing scheme. It's something that's happened before. But like you said, I can see it going up in volume just based on the nature of what's happening with
And
COVID.
that makes sense. And not only because people are working from home, so they might need to switch to a different form of payment, or like if you were cutting checks to direct deposit, but it also makes them more likely to succeed because you're not in the same office. You can't just walk down and say, "Hey, do you really want this?" We're relying a lot more on, or I guess a lot less on face-to-face communication now and more on things like email and text messaging, which an attacker could spoof an email just pretty easily. And if they had credentials to compromise something, they could even get into someone's Teams chat or Slack or whatever you're using there too. So it does leave people more
We
prone to
say as
phishing.
we chat on Teams.
Exactly. I think this is technically Skype, which is still a separate product.
They
So
forced it into Teams,
actually, I
so
don't
it
know why.
counts.
All right. I do. So I. Where was my thought going with that before I was distracted by what chat thing we're using right now? Whatever. Watch out for fishes and just pick up the phone and call someone if you need to.
Yeah. The good thing is our company and your company too can have extra mechanisms in place. The email, by the way, was easy to spot because there's things in O365 or Microsoft 365, whatever it's called now, where it will tell you, hey, the sender of this email looks like this person at your company, but it's not using their normal address. So that right away is a giveaway. This person noticed it was unusual, so emailed the real address back and asked them. There's actually mechanisms, digital mechanisms you can put into your payment systems for change control of account information that would require additional sign-offs and stuff like that. So there's lots of ways to catch it, but just keep your eye out for it. You know, phishing will definitely...
Well, I was going to say, and specifically for email, things like SPF, DMARC, DKIM are all technical tools that you can have your IT team implement in order to help prevent some of these spoofs, too. Okay.
In this case, it was a bad spoof in that they used the person's name, but it was a false address, so it would have gotten past a DMARC. But hopefully you'd notice it's not the normal address.
Hopefully, yes. So let's move on to the final news story, which is actually... we've saved the best for last because this is actually an update.
Callback.
An update on a topic we chatted about back in November of last year, where we talked about some research that Symantec published on a Android malware payload called X Helper. And if you remember from that episode or want to go check back, I think it was like our second week in November, the big takeaway from that was it was a highly persistent Android malware payload. In that there were reports at the time that it would survive infecting a device even through a factory reset. So if you go into your settings, factory reset, which should theoretically nuke everything off of the phone and re-image it from the backup system image, or at least return it to factory defaults, it should remove everything, but this malware infection was still there after that. And at the time, Symantec and I think it was Malwarebytes were the two main organizations researching it, and they couldn't really explain how it was able to do this. Like, they thought, well, was it pre-installed with the phone? Is there some sort of exploit it's hitting? Well, it turns out just a few weeks ago, I think it was the 7th of this month, I guess just a week ago, Kaspersky, a researcher at Kaspersky, published a blog post where they actually had some insight into how X Helper is gaining this hardcore persistence onto Android devices. So it was a multi-step process, actually. When X Helper infects a phone, it actually has another Trojan that assists it. And the first thing it does is it has to obtain root on the phone. And that's usually through an exploit, which means that it's most devastating on an older device that hasn't received security updates, or I guess really any Android device that isn't a flagship phone in the last 6 months or so, it seems, because they just stop updating them randomly. But anyways, once it would gain root access on it, it actually remounted the system partition on the phone in write mode, which requires root privileges. And then it would run a script, funny enough, called forever.sh, which writes several executable files to the system binary directory, and then modifies the install recovery script, the thing that's run when you factory reset the phone, to add those malicious files back to the current running system directory. It also had some protections in itself. It set all files to immutable to prevent deletion off the phone, and then would also modify the system library itself and change the code that allows remounting the file system to prevent the user or other applications from remounting the file system back into write mode to delete the malware. So it was actually interesting how it did that, and it did a lot of work to make sure that you just could not get that thing off the phone. Like, by default, you couldn't delete the files without modifying the permissions. You couldn't remove those basically rootkitted files because they changed the system library, so you couldn't remount the file system yourself. It did a pretty good job of gaining persistence there, and I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, it looks like good work. You can remove it, though, now that we know how they did it, though, right? But you might need root yourself.
Yeah, or... it's a bit of a process.
So you go into recovery mode. Yeah.
Yeah, you have to go into recovery mode, if possible, manually copy over the original system library file, the libc.so, to gain back those permissions to remount the file system, and then remount the file system in write mode. And then from that, you can remove the malware from the system partition. Alternatively, if you have root access, you can reflash the entire phone just from scratch again. That's different from doing a factory reset through the menu. This is entirely reflashing the firmware, which does require root access in most cases. So it's one of those where if you don't know how to gain root or you're not comfortable, it's basically an RMA of your device because there's no real easy way to get this malware off. The good news is, like I said, the malware has to obtain root access somehow on its own through an exploit. And so it really only affects older phones that aren't receiving updates and that have these exploit vulnerabilities on them. And then, of course, it has to somehow get on the phone. So far, neither Symantec, Malwarebytes, or Kaspersky said that they found any evidence of this being distributed through the App Store, the main Google Play Store. So it's most likely coming from sideloaded applications or other ways onto the device. So another good tip is just don't install sideloaded applications unless you know exactly what you're doing and you've verified the authenticity of it. I feel like we've talked about that a few times on the podcast too. There was a real bad one when, what was it, like Super Mario Run, like some Nintendo mobile game, came out only in a few regions first. And of course, a lot of people didn't want to wait for it. So they tried to go download it from other websites. And that download they had the legitimate game, like it would run and play, but it also had like a crypto miner caked into it or something.
Yeah. I was going to say, you know, if you are a power user and you want help figuring out how you would remove this type of malware or get root so that you could literally reflash, I used to love xda-developers.com, cool site. But in hindsight, if you don't know what you're doing, you know, everything you do when you root your phone and then allow side loading left and right, cool, powerful stuff. It's a great learning experience, but you can get yourself in trouble. As you just pointed out, Mark, you know, simply side loading something from a different region often is what gets malware there. So check out xda-developers if you are a power user and you just want to learn Android more. It's a cool place, but if you're going to do that, be careful. You can put yourself at higher risk if you don't know what you're doing.
And not just that, you do actually run the risk of breaking your device too if you flash firmware the wrong way. Annoyingly enough, so I got like the Samsung S10e or whatever, like their basic version of their now last generation phone. And they'd go through a lot of work to make sure that you cannot root that device and install something on it. Like they've got systems in place where if you don't do it absolutely perfectly, it intentionally bricks the device. It's like their secure bootloader that there's really no way to get around it without reflashing the firmware anytime you run into an issue. I started digging through it and I realized that I'd rather just keep the phone as is and not mess with any of that right there. It did make me miss my old phone that came with a unlocked bootloader and just a vanilla version of Android open source on it, which was quite nice.
I used to root and jailbreak everything, but at this point I ain't got no time for that. As you say, it's getting harder and harder. And the value of it is lesser and lesser now that the default OSs are doing a lot of stuff I used to do manually. So
exactly.
It's fun when you wanted to learn, but now I've learned and I don't really need to do it anymore.
Pop Corey's had his fun and he's ready just to use his iPhone now.
Yeah. I'm sad to say I never modded my current generation Xbox. So maybe I'm not going to a hardware hacker anymore.
You still have time. There's still a few months until the next Xbox comes out.
PlayStation 5.
Exactly.
Cool.
Well, I guess that's it for this week. Yeah. Main takeaways. What? Don't reuse your password. Watch out for your stolen stuff on the dark webs.
Don't sideload crap from third parties.
And make sure your bank account doesn't get hacked.
Don't click on links in email.
In fact, might as well just unplug the computer and call it a day. It's nice outside. Go out and get some sun. Hey, everyone. Thanks again for listening. As always, if you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe. If you have any questions on today's topics or suggestions for future episode topics, you can reach out to us on Twitter. I'm at @XORRO_. Corey is at @SecAdept. And the both of us are at #The443Podcast. Thanks again for listening. I think it's time for my nap, too.
Both of us are going to take a mid-afternoon nap.
Bye.
Not really.